It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A thick blanket of wildfire smoke from Canada and Minnesota is creating unhealthy air and hazy conditions in parts of Wisconsin. The State Department of Natural Resources says the smoke levels are some of the worst on record, and they advise people to stay indoors and wear masks outside.
Yesterday, air quality was considered hazardous in much of the state, especially around Milwaukee and in the northern reaches of Wisconsin. Today, the state remains under an air quality alert, but a shift in wind direction is expected to clear the severe smoke later today.
We'll be learning about the health effects of poor air quality and what precautions to take with a respiratory therapist.
But first, an outlook on conditions in the coming days.
Ben Shepherd is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service Forecasting Office, Milwaukee, located in Sullivan. Ben, welcome to the program.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you for having me.
What weather patterns has brought the smoke down from Canada and over from Minnesota to Wisconsin?
Well, we've had a broad high-pressure system kind of camping out towards central portions of Canada, around where the fires themselves are located in the Arrowhead of Minnesota and western Ontario, Canada. That high-pressure system keeping the weather up there dry and then also causing a bit of a northerly wind flow. So winds from the north overspreading Wisconsin and gradually pushing that smoke downwards into the state.
What parts of the state are seeing the worst of these smoke plumes now?
The worst of it generally has been closer to the source, closer to the fires themselves. So northern and northeastern portions of the state. Yesterday into the overnight hours into this morning, it's currently kind of overspreading northern, northeastern, and just generally the eastern half of the state with hazardous to very unhealthy levels of air quality due to that smoke.
What factors influence how poor the air quality in an area will be?
The main factor for this particular event has just been the wind's direction, kind of pulling that smoke in from the source region, from those fires. Additionally, we've been looking at the stability and slow-moving nature of the air, which has prevented the smoke from vertically mixing upward. In other words, that smoke remaining in those dangerous concentrations and just kind of lingering in the area as opposed to mixing around.
But we do have a change in wind direction later today. What might that mean?
Yeah, so we have a developing low pressure center kind of around where those fires are, northern Minnesota, western Ontario, and that's going to induce a southwest wind through the course of today. What that's going to mean is we expect a gradual west to east clearing in the smoke. That's we're already beginning to see some improving air quality towards Minneapolis. That spreading east through the course of today might see some of that smoke get trapped in the marine layer of Lake Michigan. So maybe the smoke lingering as late as this evening for lakeshore areas along Lake Michigan, north of Milwaukee. But other than that, some better air quality on the way today.
Will the smoke return at some point as hundreds of fires continue to burn across Canada?
Yes, those fires do indeed continue to burn, and we do expect yet another period of smoke to return this weekend, specifically tonight through Saturday morning, a cold front dragging some smoke, generally lower concentrations, just some trace amounts coming in through that period, and then a more dense plume of smoke arriving from later Saturday morning through Saturday afternoon across the state of Wisconsin. That one coming from that same region of fires discussed earlier, and the concentration of that generally looking not quite as bad as what we're seeing now, but still quite impactful.
Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Ben Shepherd is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service Forecasting Office, Milwaukee, that's located in Sullivan. Now to talk about the health risks of the wildfire smoke and precautions that we can take, we're joined by Amanda Pereira, respiratory practice specialist at Frederick Hospital in Milwaukee and vice president of the Wisconsin Society for Respiratory Care. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So air quality maps, they've shown a range of severity in colors like orange, red, maroon over Wisconsin in the past 24 to 48 hours. What are health risks that are associated with the air quality index color code system?
Yeah, as the air quality gets worse, we're going to continue to see more and more signs and symptoms of those that are at high risk for respiratory disease, but also in anybody that has healthy lungs as well. Some of the things that we can see are coughing, throat irritation, burning eyes, and then continued chest tightness, shortness of breath, and some wheezing from the irritation of those particles in the air.
Now, I know my kids, their swim practice, for instance, was shut down this morning. No pool time outdoors. Should people be changing their habits when the map is all red or even maroon?
Yeah, absolutely. The best thing that you can really do to avoid this is to stay inside, limit time outdoors. Try not to exercise strenuously or at all outside, limiting keeping exercise inside, really even keeping windows closed, running air conditioning, and then making sure that they're taking their prescribed respiratory medications if they're on anything. If people are unable to stay inside their own homes or do not have air conditioning, I would recommend finding public spaces that do have some air conditioning. I usually recommend malls or libraries that are free to people.
Okay, malls, libraries, and in malls, you can also do some walking as well. You've got the chilled air, and you can breathe easier.
Absolutely.
Who are in sensitive groups, and why do these people need to be more careful in this moment?
Yeah, so the people we're most concerned about are those with respiratory disease, mostly asthma and COPD, whose lungs can easily be triggered by that irritation from the particles. Anybody with heart disease as well, as we're having to work harder to breathe, that can put increased stress on the heart. And then anybody that is more susceptible, older adults, young children, and anybody that's pregnant.
People who aren't in these groups, they may be tempted to just go about their day as usual. What kind of health risks might they face?
Yeah, this will affect anybody. Mostly you're going to start having coughing and that throat irritation. You might start feeling some wheezing or chest tightness. Your airways are going to react, so you might still have some of those signs and symptoms that somebody with asthma or COPD might have.
And so that can, those symptoms could stay for a while even once the air clears?
Yeah, if you have relatively healthy lungs, those should clear quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But if you are older or are a young child, somebody that's pregnant, those could be more sustained. As you said, we are going to continue to see these fires throughout the summer, and that prolonged exposure could lead to more reactive airways, potentially pneumonias and bronchitis in some of those more affected groups of people.
Amanda, in the recent hours, have you been seeing an influx in respiratory patients at your hospital? What are you seeing?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot more people in the ED, which we anticipate when the weather gets hot and when we start seeing these smoke advisories as well. So just a lot more people in the ED getting those nebulizer treatments and being seen.
Is there any comparison to smoking cigarettes as we inhale this air? Can it cause lung damage?
We could see prolonged lung damage. I don't know what the comparison would be to cigarette smoke, but anytime we're adding some sort of irritant or foreign material to the lungs, there is always risk for damage to the lungs.
Let's go inside the home. How can people keep the air in their home cleaner when the outdoor air is so toxic?
Yeah, the best thing that you can do is try to avoid having any of it come in, keeping windows and doors closed, potentially sealing off those windows with plastic like you would in the winter with the cold air, and then putting in HEPA filters if you have that availability. Once some of the smoke dissipates, making sure that you are changing out air filters in your heating and cooling systems as well.
Yeah, I was just checking ours yesterday to see, you know, if it needed to be switched out. We normally kind of do it more seasonally, but yesterday we were down there making sure we had a fresh new filter. Is there anything I should look at with those filters that could help filter out and trap these contaminants?
Yeah, I would just look for something that is high quality that can trap it. I am not an expert in mm-hmm. filters, but I would say even more increase in changing those out, even outside of the fires. We are seeing more and more pollen in the air throughout the summers with the summer weather heating up earlier and earlier and that warm temperature seeing it longer. So mm-hmm. the pollen counts are also prolonged. So changing them out is even every couple of months is going to be helpful for your respiratory health in the home.
You mentioned the library and the mall during the day really can help. If people don't have an air conditioner with an air filter and, you know, at night for sleeping have to open their windows to stay cool, what would you advise?
I would try, again, to keep windows closed as much as possible or keep them cracked as small as able. And then running fans in the room, I would have that fan facing away from you as well so that those particles aren't blowing straight into your face.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That is Amanda Pereira, a respiratory practice specialist at Froedtert Hospital in Milwaukee and vice president of the Wisconsin Society for Respiratory Care. Earlier, we touched base with Ben Shepherd, meteorologist at the National Weather Service Forecasting Office, Milwaukee, that's located in Sullivan. You can join in and send your pictures of what you're seeing with air quality. Send your stories. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Ken.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Democratic primary race for governor saw a shakeup this week, with Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez firing her campaign manager for what she called serious mismanagement.
Our reporters at Inside Wisconsin Politics unpack the drama and look at the fundraising reports in the race to replace Governor Tony Evers.
Joining the discussion now are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin senior political reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR political reporter Rich Kramer.
Before we get started with our discussion here, let's play a clip from Sarah Rodriguez from a press conference this week that we definitely did not see coming last week. This was a press conference that she held on Monday, the day after she told us that she had fired her campaign manager. This was over campaign finance reports that she said showed that she had hundreds of thousands of dollars less than she had expected. She said she noticed these when she was getting ready for her TV ad buy to start playing on the air. It never played. Turns out she didn't have the money. She was asked how she let this happen, and here's what Sarah Rodriguez had to say.
What I will say is this, is that I met regularly with my campaign manager about how the campaign was going. And based on the information that I received and the information that our partners received, it looked accurate. I trusted her to do the job that I had hired her to do, that she had done for her entire career. And I regret placing my trust in that individual.
And Sarah Rodriguez went on to say that it was her campaign manager who had approved a press release promising a $1 million ad buy. That $1 million ad buy is not going to happen. She just didn't have the money for it. She did announce a new ad buy. It will be smaller. We don't know how much smaller, because she has substantially less money. My question to both of you is, as we look at this race, to me, it feels like it completely changed the fundamentals of this race. Zach, is that the impression you get? And my next question is, why?
Absolutely. This has changed everything. Just a week ago, we were talking about the momentum that Sara Rodriguez had with multiple candidates dropping out, endorsing her. Could she coalesce as the main rival, the centrist moderate candidate in this race that a lot of Democrats were looking at? And that it seems to be out the door. I was on the road this week following up with the other four Democratic candidates in this primary. And so I had the ability to be in a lot of areas of the state where there were a lot of Democrats who are still processing this. This was rank and file voters. These were county members. These were some elected officials. So the whole strata of people. And for most of them, it was, how does this happen? And the number one rule of any campaign is, You demonstrate your ability to be an executive by how well you run your campaign in the first place. And you often don't get credit for it, but you definitely get penalized when things go awry. And when you're missing this much money and you are this far out of the loop, the number one question from everyone is, how did this happen? So there are people that are reconsidering whether they think she has enough votes to win a primary and if she's the best candidate to take on Tom Tiffany in the fall from the Democratic perspective. And it kind of has a dual firing squad purpose for her, and one in that there are people that support her still but are more worried about whether others still support her, so they fear backing a candidate that's not going to win in the primary. So they're having to reconsider, well, should I go for my next favorite candidate? Even though I still like Sara Rodriguez, should I switch to a Joel Brennan or a Kelda Royes or a Mandela Barnes or a Francesca Hong, the other candidates in this race who are looking to take advantage of this opportunity and pick up some of those soft Sara Rodriguez supporters?
Yeah, I mean, when a big part of your pitch to voters is that you are the candidate who can win, you're making that electability pitch as you hit the home stretch here. Anything that kind of calls that into question hits you harder than you might hit if you were just a candidate who was kind of an issue candidate or a candidate who had really solidified one section of the party. Rich, what's your read on this? Why was this so big seemingly and affect not only Sara Rodriguez's campaign, but everybody else's?
Well, what we saw was it was a Democratic primary that was starting to get a little heated in terms of attacks toward between the candidates, but it was very muted. And then it got a little hotter. But this just kind of, you know, scattered blood in the water. And Democrats like Mandela Barnes, Joel Brennan, Kelda Royes, Francesca Hong, all of them really just went on the attack. Some of them got very vicious about, you know, asking questions. Why? How could this happen? Just trying to keep it in the news cycle. Some accused her of just, you know, bad campaign management or worse. It was really remarkable, some of these statements that we've gotten, some of the comments that they've made to reporters or in other forums. So that, to me, is how it shook up the race. Meanwhile, Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany, who's essentially unopposed, he's making a lot of hay of this as well.
So I guess I'm wondering right now, as we record this on a Thursday, is this something where Sara Rodriguez can kind of pull out of this tailspin? You know, where people like us watch this and think, hey, that's a big deal. But voters out there look at it and say, you know, I'm actually not so worried by that.
There's a legitimate question there, because there's one tendency to think that, oh, well, this is going to evaporate all of her support. I was at Farm Tech Days in Stratford on Tuesday, and I ran into a gentleman who said that his wife had already cast her absentee ballot. Ballots are already out and coming back for Sara Rodriguez. And I asked him, well, does this change your perception of whether that's a vote that you would have wanted to make again? He said, absolutely not. My number one concern is whether this means she'll have enough money to do what she needs to do to beat Tom Tiffany and win. So this didn't change that particular voter's perspective. Last night, I was in Ozaukee County, which is part of the old Wow County. It's one of those classic cherry red Republican areas that is shifting more and more blue, lighter red every time. And they had a packed room, and they had a straw poll. All the members got a straw as they walked in the door, and they had the glasses in the back of the room. So the old-fashioned, you see how your neighbor votes. Sara Rodriguez won the straw poll in Ozaukee County. That was on a night where Francesca Hong was the speaker. She was in the room walking by the jars of straw. She came in second, But Sarah Rodriguez still won, and some of the same rhetoric came from the voters I talked to there. And these are core Democratic county members. They're proud to pay their dues and get their straw to put in the basket for Sarah Rodriguez, saying, well, my number one concern is whether she'll have enough money. And the campaign finance reports weren't fully out at that time. And right now, it does not look good for her being able to get her message out at all. So that double whammy of it's the negative news cycles and she can't get her own message through really does call into question what happens over the next week, especially as we know the Marquette poll is in the field or about to be in the field, which will really inform and persuade a lot of voters who are going to play follow the leader, who is the most electable, who has momentum. And if she had it before and she's lost it now, can she regain it?
So she is clearly looking to regain it. I mean, it's not something where she just folded after this press conference. She made a point of saying this campaign is moving forward, which I got to admit, when I walked into that press conference, I was not expecting that level of severity. And so when she brought that up, I thought, uh-oh, what is going on here? But like it seems like she's trying to kind of prime the pump, you know, make sure that that. Nothing is here, folks. We're running a campaign. We're winning straw polls. We have an ad up in the air. Look at the ad. I look good in this ad. You could imagine me in a general election. We're riding the ship on these fundraising numbers. Rich, like, what's the problem with that, I guess? Why might that not work?
Well, riding the ship with a month or so to go until the primary, right when candidates are generally trying to put as much money into getting their name out as possible, that's the problem. Her campaign and Sarah Rodriguez, they both seem pretty committed to staying in this, and they've raised a lot of money. You know, they've been doing a lot of campaigning. They've been working with donors to some extent over the years. So there's people who have already committed to her candidacy. I honestly have no idea what will happen next. I have seen speculation online that, well, if she can clear the primary, the Democratic money will come, no big deal. But it's just maybe the worst timing for this sort of news to come out from your campaign if you're trying to win a nomination.
Yeah, I mean, it does strike me that it is kind of a multiplier effect with the problems she faces. She could make a bigger case about why she's the candidate, drive the message with these TV ads. The problem is she just can't afford them. Like the money is a serious problem for her in terms of being able to hit home that message, and that could compound. You know, will donors continue to give her money? She says they are since Monday that they've gotten more money, but I think we have to see those reports before we can just kind of take their word for it at this point in the cycle.
Well, Shaud, one of the things that's interesting is we've gotten all the emails. Every one of the other candidates says that this benefits them.
Yeah.
And they're all trying to reframe this as now it's a two-person primary. And it's not the same two people in every given case. It's not even a clear frontrunner of who each one of them thinks is the other major candidate that's out there. But Joel Brennan says this absolutely revitalizes his odds of winning, that people are now looking for a backup centrist, moderate with executive experience, and talking about his experience with the DOA. Kelda Royce was saying this absolutely gives people a chance to look at her candidacy again and gives her momentum. Mandela Barnes said the same thing. And Francesca Hong just calmly just says, I've got a grassroots campaign that keeps growing and more people see why she's a favorite for a lot of them. But the question for you is, do you see any one of them that could actually claim to be able to take the most advantage from this?
I think that's a pretty open discussion here, and especially with the fundraising numbers that we're going to get into. It does seem like when you mentioned the two-candidate race, I saw that term a couple times in their statements today, it is somebody plus Francesca Hong. You know, like they have sort of conceded that she has the left wing of this primary. And that with Sarah Rodriguez stumbling, I'm Mandela Barnes and the person who can occupy that other lane, or Joel Brennan, or, you know, Kelda Royce, they all seem to think that they are in that non-Francesca Hong lane. Rich, what kind of clues did we get from the fundraising numbers today? Everybody had to report their numbers. Sarah Rodriguez, all the candidates for governor, including Tom Tiffany, the Republican candidate for governor. What did we learn in terms of how much they raised in the first half of this year?
Yeah, so this is the period between January 1st and June 30th. I've got my cheat sheet here. The two top fundraisers were Mandela Barnes and Francesca Hong. So Barnes raised around $840,000 in that period. Hong raised around $709,000 in that period. But the others weren't too far behind. So Joel Brennan brought in around $666,000. Rodriguez raised around $562,000 with a big asterisk there. Not with the report, but because of outstanding debts and other things. Mm-hmm. And Calderoy's raised around $527,000. So them's the numbers.
Okay, so a delayed answer to your question, I think they would look at that, and Mandela Barnes would say, in fact, I'm the candidate who can benefit from this, and I'm the one who goes against Francesca Hong. Calderoy's and Joel Brennan would say, actually, our reports are pretty good, and we didn't lose the 2022 Senate race, so, you know, pick us. So how about cash on hand? You know, this money raised is nice, but it is July, and you need money to get to this August primary.
Yeah, the one I want to get out of the way right away is Sarah Rodriguez's campaign said it had around $35,000 in cash on hand at the end of June. That is a big problem. And also, just to note, their campaign reported around $150,000 or so in outstanding debt. So that would, you know, theoretically go against whatever money she raises, but I'm no expert with that. So Francesca Hong, in terms of cash on hand, $411,000. Calderoy's around $406,000, and Joel Brennan had around $360,000. One thing that was interesting to me is that, you know, Democratic Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, he dropped out of the race last week, and he still had more cash on hand than Mandela Barnes. Crowley had $315,000. Barnes ended the June with $204,000. So pretty interesting numbers.
Zach, as you hear the cash numbers, what do you think their interpretation of those would be? I mean, do you hear a clear front runner just in terms of how much money they have in the bank?
It's how much money they have in the bank and how much is already committed to ads going out the door and whether that's enough to actually change the position that they're in. I asked Francesca Hong about this last night. I said, what should viewers or voters take from these campaign reports? How should they parse these numbers? And she said the thing to look at, of course, favoring her campaign, she's figuring to favor her campaign, is that it should be how many voters have given, how much have they given. And she claims she has the most support from Wisconsin, that she has the broadest support from new people coming into this electoral politics, and that some of the other comparisons are some of these other candidates are more relying on $20,000 max donors that are tapped out, that can't give any more money. But I think the bigger question going forward is how any of them compared to Tom Tiffany. And Rich, I'm sure you've got the numbers on him, and those are really striking in comparison to what we just talked about.
Yeah, to say the least. I'll just toss both the raised and the cash on hand. So during the first 6 months of this year, Tom Tiffany raised $8.7 million. I mean, that's light years beyond what all the Dems in the race have raised. Of the money that Tom Tiffany reported raising, $6 million of that came from transfers. And at the same time, GOP mega donors Dick and Elizabeth Uline and Diane Hendricks gave about $6 million to the Wisconsin GOP. So they're able to do those unlimited transfers. But Tom Tiffany, he spent a ton, and he has he's got more money on hand right now than all of the other Dems combined, per the math I did.
You know, just when you look at the Democratic fundraising as a whole, those are not huge numbers in Wisconsin. It kind of struck me this whole campaign that if one of these candidates had a big donor on their side who was willing to throw some money into a PAC and run some ads on their behalf, God, that could seal the deal. And lo and behold, somebody is running a big $2 million ad for or against one of the candidates. It's targeting Francesca Hong, basically calling her super liberal, too liberal for Wisconsin. But that is running ahead of Democratic primary in Democratic markets of Milwaukee and Madison by a Republican group. Zach, what's going on there?
Well, this is a similar group that's been playing in a lot of these Democratic primaries, trying to get a more liberal, socialist, progressive type candidate on the ballot that they think will be easier to defeat in November. It's a playbook that they've seen work in a couple of races and fail in a few others. Francesca Hong talked about that. She said she's more than happy to have them advertise for her. She thinks she's still the best candidate to win in the fall. Obviously, the other Democrats are ringing alarm bells about that, saying if this is who Tom Tiffany wants to face, then Democratic voters should be thinking twice about that. But I think the last thing that we should be talking about here is the Democratic primary last year said they were going to raise money for the contender. So whoever came through would have one of those big lump transfers. And what really stood out in this, they've only got a couple $1 million. So they have not, they're not sitting on $6 or $10 million waiting to dump into whoever wins this.
We're used to them being the juggernaut.
Yeah.
And now all suddenly the state GOP has united its mega donors and they're sitting on a lot of cash.
Yeah. So this will be a wide open race. Whoever comes through this primary, there will be a lot of ground need to be caught up to raise funds for the fall.
And I understand why they did it, why they kind of held their money through this period. But you got to wonder if in the future somebody will question why they didn't attack Tom Tiffany while he ran millions of dollars worth of ads over the course of this summer. It's an open question. I mean, we'll definitely watch it and may have the answer in a few months. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us. Our colleague Anya Van Wagtendonk will be back next week.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporter Rich Kramer.
Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Picture this. It's a warm spring day at a park on the river. Dozens of people sporting tweed jackets, wool suits, dresses, and breeches are admiring each other's shiny three-speed bicycles.
No, it's not a postcard from the pre-war English countryside. It's the start of the Lake Pepin three-speed bike tour along the Wisconsin-Minnesota border.
WPR's Beatrice Lawrence went to the start of the ride in Red Wing. She starts by talking with rider organizer Noah Holzer.
We have been doing this for 24 years as of this year, and we get a group of roughly 100 people that we lovingly refer to as nutters because we're a little nuts.
That's right. They're nuts. Because Noah Holzer and his group have come out on an 80-degree spring day, dressed in tweed suits and knee-high socks, to ride the hills of the Driftless area on antique three-speed bicycles. The bikes are comfortable, but heavy. In the words of one rider I spoke to, it's like pedaling a Cadillac.
The oldest that we'll have here is probably going to be mid-40s, and the newest is probably going to be early 80s. All of these bikes are of mostly British manufacture, and all of them are equipped with three-speed internally geared hubs, which allow them to, well, have three gears and shift a lot differently than modern bikes that we're used to.
They're decked out with picnic baskets and old saddlebags pinned with Union Jack flags and souvenir tags from previous year's rides. Plus, they've got holders for flasks and tobacco pipes and vintage bells. The only rules for this ride, no Lycra, no derailers.
One of my friends said, this is cosplay for cyclists, is what this is.
That's Mike Beatty, who hauls his bike up from San Antonio, Texas every year for the Lake Pepin three-speed tour.
Yeah, I've always thought that was a great statement about what we're involved in.
The idea from the ride came from Noel Robinson, who lived on both sides of the Minnesota and Wisconsin border. He created the tour with his friend, John Sherritt.
My name is John Sherritt. I am the previous shirt tail organizer, so my title is shirt tail organizer emeritus. So he invited us to come down and ride around Lake Pepin. Well, we thought he was nuts. You know, we're not going to ride three speeds around Lake Pepin, but after a beer or two, it made perfect sense.
In 2022, Robinson passed away in his sleep while camping on another bike tour at the age of 85. And he still looms large on this ride. His image is on pins and bumper stickers. There's even a cardboard cutout of him standing in the corner of the parking lot where we're gathered. And the ride itself has stayed close to his original vision.
This is cycling as it used to be, and it's cycling as it should be in the future. So you're actually doing a little bit of time travel. Old bike with old friends, riding an old route. And, you know, we stop at old restaurants and look over overlooks and scenic vistas that are, how do we describe that? They've been around since time began.
But the Lake Pepin three-speed tour has never been about winning. The whole point is to slow down, to take in the scenery, and enjoy life at a pace that's rare in the modern world. John Sherritt puts it best.
It's the attitude of what we call a gentleman cyclist who realizes that it's not about getting there first. It's about the ride, not about the finish. So,
personally, I don't see anything nuts about that.
Beatrice Lawrence brought us that story on the Lake Pepin three-speed bike tour. The piece was produced by Sarah Hopeful.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton.
In a rural community in central Wisconsin with a mysterious past, there's a shocking murder.
And at the forefront of the effort to solve the crime, the victim's ghost.
That's the premise of a new supernatural mystery novel by a Wisconsin author.
Madison-based writer Isabel Spotts is the creator and narrator of the audio dramas Night Faces and Middle West. Her debut novel is out next month. It's called Saint Delilah. Isabel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Before we get to the story, I want to meet your setting, West Sal, Wisconsin. Tell us a little bit about the community that this story is based in.
It's definitely based on my hometown, or I would say loosely based on my hometown, which is Nisida, Wisconsin, where I grew up, which has quite a bit of its own lore. And I kind of made changes in the story, but it's very much so based on my hometown.
Yeah, and this West Sal has some lore. A lot of the main characters moved there because of a legend of a miracle, a sighting there. What is that story?
Yeah, so it's the sighting of the Virgin Mary. And in the 1950s, there was a big pilgrimage there. And the people who originally moved there believe that if they drink the water, that they will be welcomed into heaven.
Now, how much did you use Nisida and other communities in Wisconsin to kind of say, okay, this is how I'm visualizing this downtown or this landscape or this forest?
Definitely. I would say like kind of the natural aspect of it is very, very close to my hometown, which is beautiful. There are so many beautiful areas in Wisconsin and in central and northern Wisconsin that I kind of drew from. But the town itself is fictional. That's very much out of my own mind, yeah.
Now, that's the place. The people, two women, are at the center of this story. Delilah, this isn't a spoiler. She's dead.
Yep.
She's a ghost participating in the story. And Magda, and I love the line, Magda wasn't a witch, but she had her ways.
Yes,
tell
yes,
us about
absolutely.
Magda and Delilah.
Yeah, so Delilah is, you know, she's the heart of the story. She is, I based everything around her. I really wanted to subvert the dead girl trope. Mm-hmm. We have so many stories where at the beginning of the story, we have this body of this woman and we never really get to know her. We just kind of investigate her. And I wanted the story to be about her. I wanted it to be from her point of view. And so that's kind of how she was born. Magda, my pronunciation is Magda. I based her a lot off of my grandmother and great grandmother. So she is like a very sassy, cool lady. But she's also like a lot of women I feel like I knew growing up, except for maybe the witchy ways.
And that idea of taking this, we've all seen the TV shows and the books and the movies, and there's a beautiful young woman found brutally murdered. And this very much changes it, and we very much understand this from Delilah's perspective, even as a ghost. Why was it important to you to tackle that? Because I think we've all seen that story so many times.
Yeah, I just felt like it was a story I wanted to tell because I wanted to hear that story. I wanted to take that back. There's so many times when you read that or you're watching it in a film that I myself would say, what about her? Like, I want to know her story. That seems to be the most interesting. But I always felt that we kind of would come to her from a place of judgment, even if we don't mean to. Like, I think oftentimes, like, when you hear something like Delilah's a dancer, when you hear that, you're like, you make this mental note like, oh, that's why this happened. And I wanted us to see her for who she really was.
Now, a great moment for me, another twist on my expectations. Magda, right, she delves in the supernatural in many ways. And she comes up to the sheriff and talks about how she wants to take over this investigation. And I know what happens in your normal story. Butt out, lady, none of your mumbo jumbo. Well, the sheriff respects her and reluctantly goes in. You have a lot of, I think, twists on what I would expect in a mystery type story, a supernatural story.
Yeah, I think that I wanted the women in this story to be respected and revered. And, you know, Magda, she's earned everything that she does. She has earned it. And so, yeah, that is a point in the story where you could say, this isn't believable. Would this sheriff really do this? And it's like, if you knew Magda, yeah, he would. Also, you know, there is a little bit of that trope there of, will this girl even be missed? You know, and so of the small town crime that doesn't get solved, that the local sheriff wouldn't be able to solve on his own, or maybe wouldn't have the manpower for, because, you know, nobody really cares.
There's definitely a supernatural element, right? Your main character is a ghost.
Yes.
And when you do that in fiction, you're establishing your rules for how ghosts work. Tell us a little bit about how ghosts work in your world here.
Yeah. So West Sal is a very haunted town. I don't know that you ever really know why. There's supposed to be this feeling in the story that all the superstitions that you've ever heard or that have been told to you, that they actually are true. That's kind of what I was going off of, but they don't exist for everyone. You know, you would have to have a sensitivity or you'd have to have some way into it to see these other things. And so Delilah is a ghost. There are other ghosts in the story as well, but she also is at risk of becoming a poltergeist. And that is because, you know, when she died, the violence of her death kind of kept her in this in-between. And the longer she stays there, there are these creatures that threaten to turn her into a poltergeist.
And I love that element because there's a ticking clock that it's not just can she help solve her own murder? It's can she resolve this in time before these horrific ghostly entities do even worse stuff to her?
Yeah. And that was kind of part of the lore of the town, too, is to find a way to, you know, describe how ghosts become poltergeist or how like a spirit may go from just being, you know, this grief-ridden entity to something darker. Or, you know, for Delilah, it was important that she's carrying anger. But we want to resolve that anger, too.
Madison author Isabel Spatz is with us talking about her new book, Saint Delilah. Now, this novel grew out of your dramatic podcast that was called Night Faces. It isn't just, I've listened, you're not just transcribing, it doesn't work that way. What was the process like moving from an audio storytelling format to the printed page?
It was interesting. I think that there is an element with audio dramas where I didn't have to, like the writing itself, I could get away with a little bit more because I knew I could deliver it. And so I wouldn't necessarily have to write this incredibly emotional scene. I could rely on the way I was going to tell it and say it, you know, and the music, too. That was such a huge part of it. And then when I you know, turned it into a novel, I had to go back into those scenes, and many of which, I mean, I would say the novel is very different, but you're kind of having to put a different level of heart into the writing itself to really bring forth those emotionals.
I'll go with emotionals. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, to bring forth the emotion that you want in the story.
That sounds challenging, though, because as you say, if I'm doing it out loud, I'm okay,
yeah.
Right? How do you convey that emotion differently when you know, it's in Rob's head how he's reading the delivery as opposed to your voice with that delivery?
Yeah, I mean, the voice was a crutch for the audio drama. Absolutely was. I would say the voice and the music, it made it so sad and so emotional, or it made the really heavy-hitting part so heavy-hitting. And, you know, luckily, I love writing and I love prose, and so I had a lot of fun, you know, turning it into a novel and spending more time in those parts and really having to draw out a lot of interiority and, you know, make it so we could really, really experience what those characters were feeling.
Well, and then you've got the advantage in a novel, of course, internal monologue that's easier to convey than in the audio format.
Absolutely. I would say in the audio format that, and I love to write an internal monologue, love it. And so in the audio format, I would have to kind of back away from that a little bit. And in the book, it's 100% there.
Now, you've got the two audio podcast dramas behind you. Now this debut novel, what are you tackling next?
Well, I have a second book with my publisher that I'm working on now. It's hush hush because it's not released yet. And then I think it's novels going forward.
As a radio guy, I mean, I love the audio format. Would you think about going back to that for a future project?
100%. In this current moment, no, just because I don't have the time with all the writing I'm doing. But I do talk, since my husband and I did the projects together, I talk to him about it a lot because it was just fun. It was really fun. I mean, we were out in the woods, you know, recording monster noises. I mean, that was just hilarious and fun.
Isabel, thank you so much for sharing the story with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That was Madison-based author Isabel Spots. We've been talking about her debut novel coming out next month. It's called Saint Delilah. She'll appear at a book launch on August 11th at Room of One's Own Bookstore in Madison.